Welcome to Brick Talk Live, a podcast about the restoration of brick buildings and historic town centres and the science behind it. Fellow Brit Alan Pettingale talks to key people in the industry about improvements in methods of restoration, as well as the concerns and issues that come with such projects. Hello and welcome to Brick Talk Live. Today, Al is going to be talking to a friend of his, Mike Schuler, and they have just established that they met in 2006. So this is going to be their backstory about going to the Masonry Society and Al actually being scared for once and how they met each other. So go ahead and tell us how you met.
All right, Jill, thank you very much. Do you want to take it, Mike?
Well, no, you start off, Al. I want to hear the story about you being scared because that's a good I can hold that one over.
Okay, you can. All right, so having a background in masonry restoration in the UK, I came to America, and my first presentation was at the Corps of Engineers while I was on vacation. My sister helped me get in with the Corps of Engineers to give a presentation on cavity wall tower replacement at Fort Knox. They said you've only got half an hour, and 3.5 hours later, I was fascinated by America and they were fascinated about what we've been doing. So I went back to England and I was talking with my friends back there, and I said, man, I should go back there one day. Well, I ended up enough courage to come back one day and have a look at America. And it was hard at first because certainly America was totally different from the UK. As you say, in America, I certainly wasn't in Kansas anymore.
No, and to be in restoration.
And working
on old buildings here was a novelty back then.
Correct. And one of the things is I couldn't find any people that I could discuss it with in depth. And by chance, one day, I read an engineering magazine. And in the engineering magazine was an article by a professor called Tom Grimm. And what he said was that masonry, because there was no internet then, was falling in America every 2 weeks.
Yeah, he had some great statistics. He was collecting newspaper articles from all over the country about, you know, parts of facades falling in the street, and it was documented. There actually people were getting killed.
Correct.
I hate to say, but fairly often, several times a year by like a cornice falling off 5 stories up, or a brick, or a whole facade collapsing into the street.
So I was reading this article and I thought, man, this guy really, really knows his stuff. It was great. There was no internet. So I had to do a bit of research and track him down to Austin, Texas, where he lived. And I got his telephone number. So I was sitting there one time and I thought, all right, Alan.
Wait, where were you living at the time?
I was living in McKinney here.
Oh, so pretty. Not so far. Same state, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to get across Texas.
Well, I've been working in epoxy design for a few years and with concrete restoration. And I met a guy called Eric Nelson who did forensics. And he asked me to come down to Dallas and work with him and on some of the buildings for forensics, because my background was cavity wall tie replacement and anchors.
Right.
But I'd done a lot of surveys in the UK. So what he did was he called me in and I went on all kinds of different investigations from university and San Antonio.
When was that?
That was way back about 15, 17 years ago before I really got into it, you see.
Well, I bet it was before that.
I probably
you think about
time is a strange one. It's correct.
Longer ago than that.
Yeah, I think it was probably longer than that, actually, to the 2000 maybe. I've known him a long time.
Yeah.
But the good thing is that working with Eric Nelson, it gave me such a great insight into buildings and forensics, because that's what he does.
Right.
And we came at it from non-destructive and destructive techniques. And we really
there weren't too many people doing it back then.
No, there wasn't.
You know,
and I even came from England with my boroscope and endoscope.
That's
with
pretty good.
With a camera attached that you could take a picture in the cavity.
That was brand new back
that
then.
That was brand new
nobody
back then.
Nobody else could do that.
Uh-huh. And I,
well, we could.
Yeah. And I even brought my metal detector to locate the cavity wall ties, which was IMP in England.
I brought the
handheld, beautiful machine.
The little circular with the big wand on it.
That's the one. So I brought it over here and was getting into that. Anyway, back to the Tom Grimm thing. So having done getting a decent insight into America, a small insight, I phoned up Professor Tom Grimm and I said, my name's Alan Pettingale, because my ID card was still wet. I mean, I didn't know anybody. So I had to introduce myself.
He was a crusty guy.
He was a tough old bugger. I mean,
he always liked me. I don't know.
Yeah, but the thing is that our association of you, me, Ben Harris, and a few of the other guys were all in.
Ben was working
with Ben Harris, so you got the with Tom Grimm.
That's right.
And the thing is, we've all got this interlocking. He had a big influence on all of us. It was interesting to see how you were and knew Tom Grimm, and they knew Tom Grimm. He was a teacher. And when he was teaching in UT, and this, I don't upset too many people, but they did call him the Grim Reaper when he was teaching. I remember Eric Nelson telling me.
I remember
Eric Nelson told me a story one time. That if a guy wasn't listening, you better be careful because an eraser would come right close.
Yeah.
And just to get your attention.
Rightfully so. He didn't take
BS
from anybody.
As he told him at the beginning.
So this is a smart guy.
This is going to be hard. If you're not up for it, then go home.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went down. I phoned him up and I said, can I come and see you? And he said, no. I thought, now what? Anyway, not one to give up. By the time I got him, after the fourth time I phoned him, I said to him, I said, sir, I want to come and see you. He said, why? I said, look, you're the best in the world. I'm good at masonry. And I've worked with the building research establishment in England with a Dr. Dvorky.
Oh, Dvorky was one of his buddies.
Dvorky was one of his buddies. And, and he said it then. He said, why didn't you tell me? Oh, couldn't you tell me, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things is Dr. Dvorky in England, how I met him was through a guy called Brian Hindle. Now, Brian Hindle was my mentor. He taught me about cavity wall ties, anchors. He's in the UK.
Yeah.
And when I first started.
Dvorky, I knew him. He was on some of these Rylam committees.
That's
European
correct.
Committees.
He was on. And he was the author of the Building Research Establishment 329 and the Building Research Establishment 401, which are very integral papers if you're going to do cavity wall tie replacement.
It's like guidelines.
It's very much
like in the country, the guidelines. And he authored a lot of things with the DRE.
He certainly did.
You know, on mortar, like mortar durability, a lot on NDE, non-destructive evaluation, which was the committee I was on with him over there. Rylam?
Yep.
Rylam is like the European counterpart to ASTM. We know ASTM in this country, and it's, I can't remember. It's a French acronym, but the International Union of Laboratories and Materials. So, we were writing standards back in the 90s with Bob Dvorky and the Germans, the Italians. Who else? The Slovenian, Mihat Mazovic, was on some of those, too.
Slovenians, interesting.
Oh, yeah. They had a good thing going in Slovenia.
So, the good thing is, when I did phone him up again and he said, why didn't you say so? I said, can I come and see you? He said, yes. So, I said, right, that's it. I'm off. So I get down to Austin, never been to Austin, knocks on his door like a little school kid. Oh, the guy opens the door. He's got long sideburns down here, gray
mutton
sideburns.
Mutton chops, man. Chops. Yeah, we call them mutton chops.
He had these mutton chops.
And like crazy ones. Crazy mutton chops.
No.
In a good way.
Very
funny.
Georgian almost, you know.
Yeah.
But he had an Hawaiian shirt on as well. And he had shorts.
Really?
Yeah, man.
Oh, my God.
I'm thinking, this is one cool dude. Yeah, he's a cool dude, but you won't want to mess with him. You know one of them?
Yeah.
He had that thought. So, anyway, he
said more about me. By the way, he would always get introduced as the individual with more written papers and articles, more publications on masonry than anybody else in history. He was writing like an article every month for a decade.
167?
Oh, no, way more than that. Hundreds and hundreds of things. I'll have to dig out his resume from years
ago. Well, I've still got his folder that he gave me.
Very prolific.
Yeah, I've still got the folder. So he calls me in his house and we're sitting there. And I thought, okay, he's going to take me in his office. He didn't. He pulled me into a side room. And all of a sudden, I thought I was being interviewed by the police. He said, and where are you from? What's your mother's name? What's your background? What do you do? Where did you come from? Why did you this? Why did you that? I'm sweating. I'm starting to sweat. If he'd have put a light on next to me, I'd have been worried. You know what I mean? What is your name?
Right.
Nah. So we started talking, and I was lucky enough to have met him four times. And the first time I met him, he wanted to know everything about me, my background, how did you get into wall ties and things like this. The second time I met him, we sat down, we started getting more involved, and we talk about lateral restraint anchors, papers, and the differences in America and England and Europe. And he said to me one time, he says, I'll never forget it. It was so funny because he asked me, he said, what's holding your back? And I said, well, to be honest, sir, I says, I don't have PE after my name. So he said, well, I wouldn't really worry about that. He said, tell me what a structural engineer does. So I said, what structural engineer? He looks at calcs and everything. He said, no. He said, a structural engineer has to be almost a jack of all trades because he has to look at everything from the ground up to the trusses to the walls and everything.
Yeah, start to finish. Materials too, everything. Mm-hmm.
But you, Alan Pettingill, you are a master of your trade of masonry retrofit and anchoring.
Right.
So you are indeed a master of your trade. Can we carry on?
Tom Grimm said that.
Yeah, to me.
Oh, that's great. That's a good endorsement.
My whole life just went, wow. He's right. I am good at what I do. I might not have a lot of letters after my name, but I've got a lot of field experience and worked on monuments in the UK.
There are a lot of letters after your name. Just can't say most of them.
That's true. As my teacher said.
We'll give you some letters.
Yeah. But to get back to it with Tom Grimm, as we became very good, I just liked the guy and respected him, and we talked. And he said to me, he says, so what's in the future? I says, well, he said, why are you here, Alan? I said, no, I'm not going to tell you because you'll laugh. So I said, I won't. Tell me. I said, okay, I've come to put America back together. He said, bit of a tall order, Alan, isn't it? I said, no, not me, sir. I said, not me personally, but the systems we've implemented in the UK that can be brought here and would work absolutely great because we've tried and tested them.
Well, and that's so important. We get so much out of the international experience. I tell a lot of people here in the US to work on old buildings, doing structural restoration is a highly specialized. Hardly anybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Europe and other parts of the world, all the engineers, all the contractors, they deal with it on a daily basis. You know, so they're doing that kind of stuff every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we learn a lot from not just in the UK, but all throughout Europe. And there are some really, really good.
The Germans?
Good experience.
Really good.
And the Italians.
They're into really
good. That's kind of the base of my, part of my knowledge base too, working with the UK and in Italy for years and years.
Italy's just brought in a big retrofit and they're doing a lot of tax incentives.
Oh, yeah.
Referring their buildings.
For earthquake.
I think it's Helifix UK. They're doing a lot of anchors to Italy.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, backing it up because they've got a great background in the UK.
Yeah, and they've got kind of like a live test bed there throughout Italy because they do have decent sized earthquakes, not every year, but every 5-8 years. And so they've gotten to see how some of these retrofit techniques work. And one of the things that they've backed off on, for example, that used to be more popular to stiffen up the floor diaphragms by putting, because the wood, historic wood floor, you know, the floor framing was very flexible.
Yes.
And in an earthquake, that causes certain issues with a heavy buildings like stone and brick.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, they were putting concrete overlays to stiffen up these.
Right.
And then they found out, well, it didn't perform so well in some earthquakes is that concrete has a lot of mass, and that's what drives all the seismic loads. So they backed off of that, and they're doing some other things instead. So So they're learning.
Germany,
and
Holland. Yeah, Holland, as we were discussing.
Oh, the Dutch people. Yeah, we were discussing
yesterday, weren't we, about the Dutch?
What was that? You know, yeah.
Merankers. The Dutch Merankers in the lowlands.
Merankers.
Okay, get sexy.
Yeah. So Muranker. Muranker.
They were doing anchors in the 1850s.
And that's just, by the way, I had to look it up because I had never heard that word. I looked it up yesterday. It's a wall anchor. Mure is like Dutch for masonry.
Yeah.
It's like a big X piece of steel or plate on the outside that
they use it for anchoring. They actually, the Dutch Merenka was designed in the lowlands. So what it was that the buildings, they knew it was peaty and things like that, that the building would move. So rather than come back in and retrofit it, peaty.
Oh, peaty, like peat.
No. the peaty that you put in the fire and cook the lamb on. Get out of it. Anyway,
I gotcha. Peaty.
So on the lowlands, what they did was they put the anchors into the buildings to hold them together before they built them, as they built them.
Sure.
They knew it was going to move. Yeah. But then what they did was they got creative and they'd use the signage of the anchors on the outside for the facade of the building as well. The signage would hold the building together. It's pretty cool, actually.
That's awesome.
And then the Brits, I mean, we're talking about, it's funny.
So China, that's right, because one of those examples was shown, like, was it the date the building was built or was it the address?
It was the date.
Yeah, it was like 1768. Yeah. Big numbers, like three feet tall. Well, that was part of the anchor.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so not pretty only cool, did they it? Did they tie the wall to the roof, but they did it in a way that, they used that anchor to...
They did.
As a just big numbers.
And then there was the English, the Patera's plate, Patras with a cooked bowl with anchors going through. Oh,
Craig Bennett still uses, he calls a Patras plate here and nobody knows what,
I do.
But you got to know what you're talking about. Yeah, I do. To know what a Patras plate is, because we'll put that in a project spec or a detail, say, hey, put this Patras plate, and I always get a call.
But the Americans call them earthquake anchors because it's seismic with a retrofit up in California.
90% of them that are put in are not for earthquakes. So
no, that's true.
Let's call them just Patras plates.
Yeah.
We get the terminology right
but
here.
The thing is that we're talking of technology here that's coming on and on. But we were, none of Europe was the first one. It was the Greek and the Romans that were doing it. So it's the same two steps with a little twist. Except now we're moving on to technological area where we're talking cementitious grout.
Well, and that's always struck me. We've forgotten more than we think we know.
Yes.
You know, you work back and you look hundreds and thousands of years ago what they were doing. Oh, yeah, that's a really good idea, you know, what they're doing. And, you know, some of the recent past, buildings that were constructed in the recent past, like 50, 80, 100 years ago, they have some of those features, but not always. Gosh, if we just had... wall anchors in every building?
Yeah.
I'd probably be out of a job.
Yeah, six foot on center and stabilize it.
Crazy that
there
are so many buildings with nothing.
No, and freestanding. We'll get to that down the line. So anyway, we're going to get off track.
What were we talking about?
Tom Grimm.
Mr. Grimm.
The man himself. All right, so let's get back. Tom Grimm. So Tom Grimm asked me if I would do something for him at the meeting. And I said, sure. And if there's one thing I should have learned when I was in the military, never volunteer. So, but I did. I said, yeah, okay. So he sent me off. I says, I want you to go to the Masonry Society. I'm an Englishman. I ain't got a clue. Anyway, I says, yeah, okay, I'll go. And I said, but are you going? He said, no, you're going to go in my place. Yeah, what? Me? Why are you sending me? What am I going to do? Get him a few beers in and we're all going to have a laugh or what? And he looked me in the eye and he said, no, Alan. He said, I'm sending you there because you're going to make a difference. What? Me? What am I going to do? Anyway, I decided that, maybe I will, maybe I won't. So I went back and I was talking to Eric Nelson, an engineer friend of mine, and I was telling him about that Tom Grimm had told me that he wanted me to go to the Masonry Society. So he said, are you going to go? I said, well, no, I am, because I ain't got the money for it, to be honest. And I don't even know what I'm getting into. He said, I'll pay it. Go. You've got to go. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. And I thought,
perfect.
Okay. What the heck?
Yeah.
In for a penny, in for a pound. Tally-ho, old bean. Let's go. So, but what he did was before I left, he said to me, when you get there, though, I want you to go find one man, Mike Shuler, and tell him I sent you. Oh, okay. And I'm thinking, what's he do? Anyway, so I gets on a plane and I gets down there to the Masonry Society.
Where was that? Atlanta?
Apparently Atlanta. I thought it was somewhere else beginning with S, but apparently not. So anyway, it was all at Atlanta in 2006, I think I was something.
Yeah,
like
that sounds about right. Almost
and
20 years
anyway,
ago.
Anyway, so I turned up, and when I got there, a big posh hotel, and I thought, I don't know what am I getting myself into, because there wasn't no checking in them days. There was no internet to tell me what the Masonry Society was.
That's
I didn't even know what it was.
That's a good point.
So when I got there...
How would you know? I mean, it's not like you're getting something, a letter in the mail
saying...
Nothing.
Just,
that's right, because remember, you couldn't look things up.
No.
These young people, they'd say, don't
there's youngins.
Before there was an internet, it's like, how do you know? You just got to know people. You got to know things. Like Tom Gregg. Yeah.
Exactly.
It worked by word of mouth.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
it's crazy.
I get to the Masonry Society, but I'm traveling casual. In fact, to be honest, I had a pair of cowboy boots on. I had a pair of jeans.
You did.
A military rucksack with an MRE in the back.
Nice.
And a bottle of water, because I didn't know where I was going. And I always used to travel just in case.
Well, yeah, Atlanta. That's the wilds, the jungles of Atlanta.
Hold on. I didn't know where.
Did I camp out in the park?
I didn't know where. Yeah, I might have. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't even know if I had a hotel room or a bed almost.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm stood there with a Hilti t-shirt on and a black collar and short sleeves.
Nice. Yeah.
And I've got me tash down here. I've got me hair all over the place. And I've got a rucksack on my shoulder. So I walks into the hotel. I said, hello, I'm booking in. They said, oh, yeah, we've got you booked in, Mr. Penningale. And I said, well, can you tell me where the Masonry Society is? Oh, yes, they're upstairs.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, well...
Yeah.
So I get upstairs and there's all these big signs, Masonry Society, and it was the annual do.
Oh, the annual meet. It must have been like October, November.
Yeah, when they're having all the meal. All I remember is they had a chocolate fountain. They had a chocolate fountain and
said, oh, I remember. That was fun. Right, that was so, last back when they were brand new.
That's
that was
right,
kind of fun.
When they were brand new. So I was just.
Wait, that was you dipping your finger in too, wasn't it?
That was me with my tongue in it now. Oh. Come on, man. But I mean, I'm saying, when we were kids, we never saw a bloody chocolate fountain.
Yeah, that
fountain.
Was brand new.
I was stood in awe. I think I was more in awe of the chocolate fountain than it was the meeting. And then I realized that everybody in the room, there was a lot of people in this room. And one difference, they all had shirts and ties on and the ladies looked beautiful. And all of a sudden, there's this vagrant stood there opening the door.
You know, there's a lot of truth to that. That was back in the day where I'd bring like a suit coat or two, a couple ties.
Yes.
Now, no, we wear a tie to a meeting these days. It's funny, in less than 20 years, things have changed.
Correct.
So much. Maybe part of that was COVID, but part of it's just, I don't know. I think, I hate to say, I think it's a better meeting when people are kind of casual and just in their own element rather than trying to put on airs, you know?
Yeah. So
that's
So I went in, opened the door, and everybody in there, I thought, I don't know anybody. What am I doing here?
Yeah.
So I thought, what can you do? So I put my hand up and I shouted, hey, my name's Alan Penningale. Tom Grimm sent me. And a guy over there came over, and his name was Richard Klinginer.
Professor Klinginer.
Professor Klinginer came over and said, Alan, Tom said you were coming. We've been expecting you.
Is that right?
And he took me over and talked. Because
he's a professor at Oxford.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
he was a great, lovely professor.
Yeah, yeah.
He pulled me over, and I started talking to Dr. Mathis.
Oh, Johnny Mathis.
Johnny Mathis was
Texas
that?
A&M.
Texas A&M. And all these greats that they all know the greats now, but at the time, I didn't know them from Adam, Mike. I wouldn't know a professor unless it had bit me on the ass, you know what I mean? It was just like, no, but I mean, I was just a lad from Yorkshire that fixed buildings and was damn good at it and used different anchors.
No, that's great.
And so, anyway, when I got in there, the next day I woke up in the morning and found out that the classes were on. And the first person I asked for was you, and you was giving a presentation. And one of the things you were giving a presentation in there was about strengthening masonry. And I remember sitting at the back.
Sounds about right.
And at the back, you were talking about mortarboard reinforcement.
Probably.
And one of the things, you had it absolutely spot on, but I asked the question of why can't you could do that around the corner as well. I saw you look across and you went, okay, anyway, that's just blah, blah, blah. And you carried on with it. And
that's a good idea, sure.
Yeah, and afterwards, I came over and I said to you, I wasn't trying to be funny in there. You said, no, you were right.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, it's not often people see things like that. And I said, he said, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm Alan Penningale. And Tom Grimm told me to come and see you. And you looked at me and went, what? I said, yeah, come and see you.
Yeah, and, well, that's great. That's a heck of an endorsement from Tom Grimm.
And then we started talking, me and Mike, and Mike's been a mentor to me and introduced me to a lot of amazing people in the Masonry Society.
Well, back then, you know, we started that committee within the Masonry Society called the Existing Masonry Committee, which is kind of a funny name for the committee, but I don't think very many people remember this. But when we started that committee, I was the first chair of that back in 1997. or 98. I don't remember what year, but the first meeting was like, okay, here we are. We're going to start this new committee. What do we call it? And well, it's what it's going to be about. And they said, well, it's going to be about evaluation. Okay. Big about retrofit, repair, restoration. So people are saying, yeah, we could call it the evaluation, repair, retrofit, or restoration committee. And I started thinking about the acronym is ERROR. You don't want this to be the error committee. Swear to God. Honest to God, that came up in the meeting. And so they all thought that was a pretty good, and I walked out of there. It's like, I am not going to be running the error committee. So after that, it's just, let's call it existing masonry.
So did you get a t-shirt?
I didn't get a t-shirt. Yeah. They thought it was all clever, but no, that's just self-defeating, you know? So we started, and back then we had quite a number of people on the committee. There are a lot of people interested. I bet we always had, we started with 30, 40, 50 people on the committee, which is a lot,
yes,
you know, with an organization, yes, that at the time had maybe 12 or 1400 members. Mm-hmm. And, but really, really there was five or six of us that had a good background, yes, in it and were, yes, contributing, and we could write public, you know, put out publications and write things related to the content. And so to have Al show up in 2006 with actually have not just interest, but experience and knowing what to do, it's like, what a godsend, you know. It's like, we need this guy around, because it's very different today.
Yes, it is.
It's amazing. You know, it's the last amazing meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, we just had a little conference call yesterday with one of the task groups of this committee. We had 20 people on there, and they are all we're writing a new code on masonry repair. And they're like writing stuff. And it's like, wow, it's like thinking back 20, 26, 27 mm-hmm. years ago when this started, and we could not physically, really could not have done it because the knowledge base wasn't there. And now, mm-hmm. it's kind of this concept of being involved in restoration has gone from a highly specialized area to, yeah, all these engineering companies are starting to realize that's a good, I don't want to say a profit center, because profits aren't there usually, but
no, that's true.
It's a good area to get work in. Yeah. And the universities, they're starting to teach it, you know, just a little bit here and there. I did a class at Georgia Tech back in February, just brought some equipment out. Met with the students. They had like a two and a half, 3 hour lab class. We got them using radar and infrared cameras and all that. And it was a class on forensics, and they were just loving it.
Yeah, I'm doing one in Clemson University.
That's right.
I've been asked to teach one at Clemson.
Yeah, and it's great. So this specialty that people were thinking about it, now it's starting to
get mainstream,
and it's kind of fun to see.
Yeah, but hold on, Mike. When you talk back, I mean, one thing I love about Mike is that, you know, when he says I was president of the existing, no one, he was there for 7 years and he put hard sweat and toil and everything.
And here we are, I'm still working on it.
But I remember one time I said to him, how can I help? And he said, just keep doing what you're doing, Alan, telling us, you know, from a practical side.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. We just need, you know, it's heavily populated with academics. It's not a bad thing, but, you know, engineers, yeah, there's professors, there's some students and things like that. But, you know, the thing we need most is some practical experience. And, you know, just to remind us that, well, you know, that's great and all, but you can't really do that.
Yeah.
Here's what you should be doing. You know, those kind of comments are so useful and so beneficial
but they to the are. Process. And I think over the years, me and Mike have been discussing, and about a year and a half ago, I gave a presentation at the Masonry Society. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I realized, and within my presentation, was that with America is still in its infancy, it would be a good idea to look around the world at what codes and how different people are doing different things.
That's right.
Like the British, they've got their standards, but also as well, there's Australians and New Zealand, because New Zealand,
China, India actually has a code on, you know, most of the time it's not repair, masonry repair per se. A lot of times it's earthquake, seismic retrofit.
Yeah.
But what was the other one? I think Kenya, oddly enough, had a pretty good code. You know, they borrowed heavily from the Euro code, I believe. But well,
don't forget, they were British, sidetrack. I mean, the Brits were in there years ago.
Oh, that's a good point.
So, I mean, they're following a lot of that.
They're now. British, what? A sidetrack?
Well, no. I said that we're in Kenya and
Africa. Right,
so,
right,
I mean,
right.
they're...
You wouldn't happen to have been in Kenya, would you?
No, once upon a time.
Yeah,
and that's another story, isn't it? But
that's a whole another story, isn't it?
In it. Moo, in it.
That's right. We'll put that meme up someday.
Anyway, so back to the TMS. So we got back there, and I must admit, one of the things that I never did get to do was see Tom Grimm again. What I didn't know, he was passing away with cancer.
Yeah, he had lung cancer. He always told the story, you know, the first time he had lung cancer for 48 hours because the doctor diagnosed him. He said, you got to go in the hospital today. We're going to cut it. And they cut it. I think they took out one lung.
Yeah.
And then eventually, he passed from lung cancer a number of years later.
Well, the thing is that when you met him at his office and things like that, on the wall, he had two engineering degrees with Grimm.
Yeah.
And the other one was his father's.
Is that right?
Yes.
I had no idea.
On his wall.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he showed me that.
But didn't he have an architect's license too?
I think so. I'm not sure about that. You might know better than that. But I'll tell you.
I got a good story the first time I met him.
Yeah.
Because it's similar. You know, I was a young kid. I had been in practice, you know, working for this company, for Atkins and Olin, for maybe like 4 or 5 years after I got out of school. No, maybe it's less than that. We had a research project on repairing earthquake damage.
Yeah.
With the University of Milan and the Slovenians.
You see, that's
GMRK in Slovenia.
Right.
And one of the best methods we found to fix earthquake damage in old brickwork is injection grouting.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was an academic project funded by the National Science Foundation. Part of what we had to do was transfer that technology. So I wrote a paper for an ASTM symposium, like a conference down in Miami. And it was my first real paper that I'd written for presentation. And I'm this young guy, this little guy, and I'm super nervous. And I get down there and in my session, and I got to know Tom Grimm because I was the last one to go in the session. And everyone that presented before me, it gets come to the question and answer session at the end. Tom Grimm would stand up and like, well, that was good, but did you look at this reference? And I think you're a little bit wrong here. And he would kind of rip these people.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just ready for it. So I'm going last and I give my little presentation and I had a couple questions and nothing from Tom Grimm. And being the irreverent guy I am, I said, Mr. Grimm, anything? And he's like, no, well done. So it's like, holy.
That's it.
That was the endorsement. And then after that.
Did you go and have a beer after that?
Oh, absolutely. We went and had a job after that because he's like, I've been looking for technology like this. And within 3 months, we had a big project in Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, wow.
Figuring out how to repair a newly built building where they left out, they built the wall without grouting the column joint between the brick and the block. So, yeah, he was my buddy. And I don't know why. Just maybe because. I don't know. Sometimes people like it when you give them a little bit of help, and
that's why I loved him to death.
Yeah.
I mean, he reminded me of an old sergeant major in the military. If you did your job, all right. If you didn't, he would rip you a new one.
Oh, and he was good friends with my the founders of my company.
Oh, Atkinson and Nolan.
Jim Nolan and Hank Atkinson.
That's
both
the founders
them.
Way back. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was good relationship for a long time. But we miss him.
I remember Tom Grimm when I was sitting at his house one time, and he said, Alan, let me give you a real good interpretation of what you're getting into here. I said, go ahead, sir. He said, listen, there's been over 12,000 papers written. And he said, do you know how many have been written on restoration? This much.
Yeah, like hardly any.
Hardly any.
Yeah, yeah.
So he said, that's where you're going to fit in. That's where you're going to go. And I know you're bringing a lot of technology and you've had a lot of experience from working in the UK with brick tie services and also moving on to WT Fixings that did all the cementitious grout anchors.
What was WT Fixings?
WT Fixings was set up by an architect. It was an architect, Hans Ramska. And he was a Swedish architect and he came to England and WT stood for wall ties. He started.
Oh, I gotcha.
So what that he did sense. Was he put together some brochures of doing all the anchors. But he was one
again
of
the, before the internet. You had to have brochures. You'd hand out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Brochures, and because he was an architect, he'd draw the most beautiful renditions and pictures of how these anchors should be and where they'd go and what they'd do and things like this. And I met him in England. Our wall tie problem was so bad we had a wall tie installers federation.
What do you mean? Like to teach people, like to certify them?
Yeah, certify them.
And that would also, be a fine thing, wouldn't it?
Also, oh, and also offer an insurance-backed guarantee for the wall ties and teachings. Ooh, it was a great concept, like, and it's still going. Brian Hindle, as I said, played a big part. And then there's Hans Ramska. I met him at the Wall Tie Installs Federation, and he said to me, what are you doing?
Did you ever go through a class? Like with get certified or installed?
Oh, no, I was already Syntec.
Oh,
Syntec Arc. I'll get to that in a minute.
Are you certified? I know you're certifiable, but are you certified?
I was in England, but when I applied for my, a guy called Reese over here was the Syntec rep, and I asked him for my badge to be given to me, and he said no. And I said, what? I said, I installed all these anchors in England with Hans Ramska, Cementatious Grout. In fact, Hans Ramska asked me if I'd go work with him in-house because they were an in-house organization. But what he used to do was he'd do like the Docklands in England. We had an explosion by the IRA one time.
Docklands, whatever. What are you doing with ducks?
Dock.
I know, I heard you.
Are you trying to be funny? Is you trying to be? Is you trying to be? Anyway, the Docklands in England. So what we'd do is we'd do the diamond coring and stabilize all the walls, and then he'd do bridges, viaducts. He did all sorts. He did all the top end stuff. And in fact, he took, I think it was near about 70% of Syntec's market. He was that installing that many.
Yeah.
And then eventually he found a way to design his own. And the Syntec Hark anchor was designed by Alphonse Hark, a German engineer, who designed the Cementatious Grout anchor.
H-A-A-R-K-E, I think,
right? Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I remember that. And he did 20 years trying to perfect this anchor. And I think a guy called Peter James in the UK bought an owl. And that's how the Syntec started.
Yeah.
And then they tried to
get... What was that, do you think?
Way back. Oh, that's into the 80s. 80s, yeah. Because, yeah. I mean...
I don't think I found 80s, out
90s.
About
80s, 90s, I think.
Yeah, I found out then, maybe mid to late
And then
90s,
they tried to bring him into America... And I think they came in through Canada. Anyway, they're still around, isn't it? But it was interesting to see how they went from cavity wall tie installation to specialized anchors. And then I came over here and there was nothing. There was nothing. Nobody did all that stuff.
Because we don't have old buildings in America.
Oh.
Sorry, that's in quotes. That's in air quotes, you know. But people don't realize we got so many.
And America's at its tipping point because... You think of it about, and I said this at the Masonry Society, if you think about it, that America, roughly 150, 200 years, but most buildings, 150, 100 years, yeah?
Right.
On historic. Now, if a brick's designed to last 100 years, and mortar's designed to be sacrificial...
Bricks are going to last way more than
that's right. Years. No, in theory is what they're saying.
Yeah, but...
I know.
Yeah, we know the truth. They're going to last hundreds of years. I think we're looking at like a 300 years... realistic service life.
It's the mortar life.
The mortars, the maintenance. Well, the older lime mortars, yeah, maybe 300 years is a stretch, but it all comes down to exposure.
Correct.
If you keep it dry, relatively dry, reasonably dry,
We've got pollutions and things like that. Anyway, we can get off track and all of that. But
yeah,
the good thing is that having met these guys and came over here, I remember talking to the guys at the Masonry Society and said, I want to do a paper. And a friend of mine, Ben Harris, said, what? I said, why can't we just write a paper in the Masonry Society? We could publish it tomorrow. We've all got it here. He said, Alex, not that easy. You're in the Masonry Society. There's a procedure and all like this.
Yeah, you got to go through like peer review and all that.
That and the other. So what we did was we decided to have a go at doing something a little bit different on the Masonry Society response. On a lateral
response. Oh, Masonry Response. Yeah. Those TMS.
And I was talking with a guy called Eric Peterson.
Available online, by the way.
Available online.
I think it's free to members. It may be accessible to non-members.
No, you've got to pay 10 or 12 bucks for each copy. There's some wonderful information in
there. Well, you should just be a member of TMS.
I think right. Come on. For a couple hundred bucks out of your life to work with some of the great people who are dedicated and really want to make a change, that's the place to be. However, I can say from a contractor's point of view, if you are going to join the TMS, do your research and be aware that it's, you want to try and be aware that there's going to be a lot of paperwork. And if you're not used to reading papers and codes and things, you might have to change a little bit.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It's worth it in the end.
Any committee activities, there's moments of heartache and frustration, but ultimately I feel like we're making a difference in getting some really good information out to the engineering community, to the contractors.
I think you're right. Yeah. And that's why when I sat
down... It's really good to see these days, you know?
Well, I sat down with Eric Peterson and I said, look, you know...
Yeah, he was the chair of that committee when you came to your first meeting. Huh? Yeah.
So I asked him, Eric Peterson sat down with me and he said, well... Why don't you write a paper? I says, I'm not being funny, but I'm not a writer, paper writer. And he said, no. He says, but we can write.
That's right.
You've got it in your head, Alan. Yeah, if you can get it out of your head, I'll help you with it.
Yeah, that's how it should work.
And do you fancy writing a paper?
Yeah, that's how it should work.
So I was so honored, and I said, yes. And it took a lot of hard work, and Eric Peterson was great. All the guys...
What was that paper on?
It was lateral restraint anchors.
Oh, okay.
For the 14th North American Masonry Conference.
That was in, I'm trying to remember.
2004, something. Anyway, the fact is that they helped me write this paper on lateral restraint anchors because why I wanted it for lateral restraint anchors.
Wait, the one in Omaha that we just had?
No.
Way before back. That was in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, it was way
before
back.
Before that was in Denver.
It was way back.
Oh, that was maybe like 10th or 11th. Then.
Yeah, it was the 11th, was it? 11th North American.
Mm.
It was the 11th. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that.
Point being, the whole idea of the paper for me was not just for everybody. What I was trying to do is, because I get involved with downtown historical buildings, I wanted to be able to offer those people who haven't got any money in these small towns a cheap and effective methodology to look at working with their engineer or architect to stabilize these historic buildings.
Right.
So that was the whole idea of me trying to do that. And the guys helped me do that. And it actually got published and was presented by Eric Peterson because I couldn't go. I think I was ill. And he went and presented it up there. But that was one of the first ever papers I ever did. And I've always said I'd never write another one, but I did. But the thing is that the guys in the Masonry Society were absolutely great in being supportive of everything. So then when we're in the Masonry Society, I said to Mike and the boys one time, because me and Ben Harris had gone down to Brownsville to look at some old historic buildings. So while I was down in Brownsville in Texas, I got talking to the local people down there and asked them, would you be interested if we did a workshop?
That was, yeah, I know. And that was still one of the best things we ever did. And we'll have to talk about that whole escapade some other time.
It was fun.
That was a big effort.
Yeah. But the thing is that's how I got into the Masonry Society, how I met Mike.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a basic start of where we're going and how we're going. But
it's good to be involved in this field. And we certainly have a lot of fun. And sometimes we're forging new ground. And that's what I like about being involved in the restoration, the retrofit, the whole error side of things.
Yeah.
Evaluation, repair, retrofit, restoration, all that stuff.
I mean, we could talk for weeks and weeks, and I'm sure over the upcoming seasons or whatever, or the episodes coming up, we'll try and cover a lot of different things. But there are so many, and it's an interesting field if you're in it to learn and carry on from there. So my name's Alan Pettingill.
My name's Mike Schuler.
And this is our darling Jillian looking after us.
Hi.
And we'll be talking to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you for joining us this week for Brick Talk Live. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or just tell a friend about it. You can learn more about Alan Pettingill at alanpettingill.com. and the podcast at bricktalk.live. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode.